You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
When mulling over which salmon to purchase in a grocery store, the price difference between wild and farm fish is cause for hesitation for many consumers. But one of the big factors that guides our purchase decisions is the level of guilt we feel. Sustainable fishing advocates have been working hard to promote public awareness about the harms of open net cage fish farming. However, according to Dr. Jennifer Jaquette, corporate shame is a more effective strategy to promote environmentally sustainable practices than the strategy of consumer guilt. Dr. Jaquette is a postdoctoral fellow at UBC Fisheries Center, and she joins me in the studio now. Welcome.
Good morning.
What is consumer guilt, and how is it used to promote the common good, or intended to promote the common good?
Well, if you see, just read the headlines, you can find that we're all feeling a bit guilty these days. So they'll say, here's a guilt-free flight for sale. Here's some guilt-free fish you can buy. Eco-guilt is on the rise. I just read a headline that said, don't worry, eco-guilt is at a low with the economic downturn. So there, if you just stay abreast of the news, you realize sort of this collective guilt is something we're all feeling, because we know nowadays especially that each of our actions has an impact on the planet.
So your viewpoint is there's a better strategy than focusing on the consumer and trying to engender this great feeling of guilt, and you call it corporate shame. So why is that better, and what is how do you pursue that strategy?
Yeah, so shame in general, the corporate shame would be one of many strategies you could use. And the thing is, if we think about how change used to occur on the planet, we were small groups, and changing the behavior of individuals actually had an immediate effect. As we've grown in size, we see that the changes in one individual are masked by the effects in other countries, globalization, the rapid pace of development. And so we really need to make big changes in small amounts of time. This is contrary to how things used to work, where we could make small changes over big amounts of time and they would add up. So if we want to make a big change, we can't really work with individuals anymore. We need to be working higher in the demand chain. And so we can work with corporations, as you mentioned. We can work with restaurants, retailers, governments, universities, any of those large consumers, so that instead of affecting your demand in your household, we can affect the demand of a mega institution.
So give me some examples of where that has worked effectively.
So one of the groups that seems to be onto this strategy is Greenpeace, for instance. They have shamed retailers in Canada. They've ranked them according to their seafood procurement policies. So they said, these are the best supermarkets and these are the worst. And in a year, we'll come back and rank you again as to how you're doing and what kind of fish you're selling. And if you have not improved at all, you'll experience some more shame. Another example that they did in Canada, which was quite interesting, was in Toronto and the Loblaws stores. They hung all sorts of banners and big signs out front of the store that said, they sell red list fish. They sold sharks, sea bass, things that really are heavily overfished. And within days, Loblaws was turning their seafood buying practices around. They were cooperating with the Marine Stewardship Council. They were trying to figure out how to change their ways. And so rather than operating with a single individual, certain groups like Greenpeace will work at that higher level, which I think really affects change more quickly.
So that could theoretically, in some circumstance, turn into, a boycott campaign, or trying to stop people investing in a particular corporation that was defying the appeals to change their practices.
Yeah, it's playing off reputation. So we're affecting the reputation. This is a highly valuable asset to any any organization. So you want to protect your reputation. And of course, we don't want to see this proliferation of shame. It's a negative emotion. It gets us down. We don't like always being surrounded by negativity. But it is a very effective tool. And so is honor on the flip side of that. So we need to use these emotions, these strategies, these verbs that can work at that higher level. An organization can't feel guilt. It doesn't have a conscience. So we have to play on reputation through shame instead.
It's strange, isn't it? Because in legal terms, a corporation is a person and given all sorts of rights as a result, but it has none of the human emotions or feelings of a human being. Are there examples which don't work for identifiable reasons, this effort at shaming? I mean, presumably they depend upon, they're an appeal as well to the consumer to say, look at the practice of this place. Do you want to really support that kind of a place? So what about places that it's difficult to do that?
Yeah, I think you're getting to a good area that I'm exploring currently, which is how do we encourage the least cooperative groups with shame if their constituency isn't affected by it. So you'll see that Whole Foods, Capers, they're very affected by reputation issues because their constituency wants to shop there so that they don't feel guilt. They want to believe that they're buying something that doesn't have a huge impact. And so what happens at the Costco's, the major supermarkets that don't have this kind of norm? And we're seeing that, you know, neither guilt nor shame is really going to work at that level. For the least cooperative groups, we might need good old-fashioned regulation.
You're also researching the role of cooperation, that it plays in advancing a sense of orienting yourself to the common good. What kind of things have you... What ways, I guess, have you researched this, and what things have you found out about cooperation?
Well, I'm researching it theoretically with a bunch of games that you can play with first-year university students. And then I'm also researching it empirically, looking at what's happening in the market. And there are a few really interesting things that come to light, not only from my studies, but from other studies as well, which is that cooperation is very hard to sustain. So in order to do that, A, your community needs to see the benefits of cooperation, and it needs to establish itself in the beginning, otherwise there's almost no hope. And also, what I just heard yesterday, another colleague at UBC has found that first-year students are actually the least cooperative because they're not very knowledgeable, they haven't really learned that cooperation. So there's hope also in integrating, and I think there's a lot of hope as I look at the planet as a whole with an aging society that we can actually become more cooperative, because they've shown that as you get older, you soften up a bit, you're willing to work with others a little bit more. So I see some silver lining to this population pyramid, as they call it.
And what are the factors that, I mean, is it, we're raised in a society, just take the Olympics, we've had those. You have athletes which have all amazing capacities and skills, and yet we insist on measuring hundredths of a second to compete against one another. Now, you're swimming against the tide with trying to promote cooperation, which... I guess when we had the question of human survival, which we do face again, but we don't aren't as cognizant of it, people work together.
But I think the Olympics, you can see, look at the honor. I mean, Olympic athletes don't make millions of dollars. They're not in it for the money. They're in it for the glory. And that actually has caused the Olympic Games, I think, is a perfect example of cooperation, where it's occurring and then some receive more honor than others if they win the gold medal. But it from what I hear, I wasn't in Vancouver at the time, but it can really, honor can also spark an increase in cooperation and this increased desire to give more if you could experience the rewards of the glory.
How would this work, integrating this notion of cooperation into managing a successful campaign for shaming corporations?
Well, there are a few things that have to happen, I think, for shame to really be effective. One is that the group doing it has to have a high public image score, we would call it. The public has to trust them immensely. If they don't, it's futile. The other thing is that it should not be directed in any way toward individuals. So shame directed at individuals undermines a democratic society. We want to protect human dignity. That's why if we want to say that this company, Loblaws, is selling fish that we don't believe in, we know that they don't have a dignity they have to protect. We would not want to do that necessarily with one single individual. A, because it would be less effective. Why change one individual? And B, because it undermines those democratic rights. So I think shame campaigns have to be very strategic, seldomly used, so that they maintain their bang for their buck, and carried out by organizations that have a lot of respect by the public. And I definitely also think that, well, from what I can read, the government is not in the best place to carry those out. That's really the role of NGOs and journalism, to explore the dynamics of cooperation in society.
Well, thanks very much for coming in and explaining your research.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Dr. Jennifer Jacquette from the UBC Fisheries Center about her latest research on how corporate shame can be an effective tactic for promoting sustainable environmental practices.